Blog Talk Radio.
Dog Works Training Centers, professional canine training center in Denver, Colorado, presents Mush, You Huskies, a show about dog-powered sports and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Mush, You Huskies, is part of Twine Group Media and syndicated worldwide on blogtalkradio.com. Here's your host, Dr. Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto hosting Mush You Huskies, brought to you by Native Performance Dog Food and Twine Group Media. I am fresh back from the Serum Run start up in Nenana, Alaska this past weekend. One of my good friends and kennel partners, Aaron McLarnon, is running in this year's Serum Run along with 11 other mushers and 9 snow machiners. And it looks like to be a very interesting expedition. It started out in Nenana in what I think Alaska weather should all be about. It was extremely windy, probably 35 miles an hour wind in some points, as well as probably -1, -2 degrees up just about 65 miles southwest of Fairbanks is where Nenana is. Today we are going to rebroadcast a show that we did with one of the Serum Run participants not only in 2009 but in 2011 as well. His name is Vaughn Martin, and he wrote a book called A Long Way to Nome, the Serum Run 25 Expedition, and it's about his trials and tribulations along the Serum Run Trail, which runs from Nenana, Alaska to Nome, and it is an expedition to commemorate the diphtheria life-saving relay serum run back in 1925, where they delivered diphtheria serum to Nome, Alaska, from an outbreak of that deadly disease. And the way it works is they delivered the life-saving serum from Anchorage to Nenana on a train. And then after that, several relay teams, including some of the world-famous mushers that everybody knows about, including Wild Bill Shannon, as well as Leonard Seppala and his dog Togo. And I'm sure a lot of people know about Balto, especially if you have kids. I'm sure you've watched the Disney animated movie about Balto. Of course, it took several liberties, but it is a pretty good story about the Serum Run itself. So today we are going to bring back Vaughn Martin, and when they get in from Nome in just a couple of weeks, about 2.5 weeks from now, we hope to have Vaughn back on to talk about his trials and experiences on the trail of the 2011 Serum Run as well. So sit back and enjoy Vaughn Martin and his book, A Long Way to Nome, the Serum Run 25 Expedition. Here we go.
Blog Talk Radio.
Dog Works Training Centers, professional canine training center in Denver, Colorado, presents Mush, You Huskies, a show about dog-powered sports and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Mush, You Huskies, is part of Twine Group Media and syndicated worldwide on blogtalkradio.com. Here's your host, Dr. Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Mush You Huskies, fueled by Native Performance Dog Food. I am hosting from Willow, Alaska, and on the line we have our co-host in Denver, Michelle. How are you?
I'm doing great. Enjoyed the 40-degree temperatures we had down here in Denver. Looking forward to some colder weather coming around the corner.
Well, you're about 5 days post-Alaska. How is things going on back home?
Well, it's been pretty busy trying to catch up from the holidays. Kyle did a good job manning the training center. You know, it's just that low time of the year with the holidays and things, and ski season is in high demand this year, so a lot of our clients are talking about going skiing and things, and that's just something that I never got into, so I have no interest in going up to go skiing.
Well, for our listeners, I want to make sure that we mention that we are going to do our annual Christmas puppies show, where we talk about if buying a puppy for Christmas is a good idea or a bad idea. We're going to have that show hosting on the 23rd, right in time of Christmas. I know a lot of people run out and buy those Christmas puppies the day before at the mall and things, so we want to make sure that we get that point across like we normally do. Since I'm up here in Alaska, I don't have the privy of being on any of the local newscasts or anything like we normally are to talk about this topic.
That's right, and I've had quite a few people calling me already about puppies that they've purchased already this year and, you know, what would they like to do. And one of our number one training packages that we offer at Denver Dog Works is the Peak Performance Puppy Obedience Package, which incorporates private lessons, group socialization, and a two-week board and train.
Sounds good to me. So this week we have a very special guest on the episode on this episode of Mush You Huskies. We have author and musher Vaughn Martin. He wrote a book called A Long Way to Nome, The Serum Run 25 Expedition. Vaughn is calling in from the Washington Cascades. Vaughn, are you there?
Robert, I'm here. Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us. I've heard a lot about you and about the Serum Run and your guys' crazy expedition in 2009. So before we get into your book, introduce yourself, who you are, what you're about, et cetera.
Well, thank you. First of all, Robert, thank you and Michelle for having me on board and talking to you about the book and our expedition. And to your listeners out there, I've really been looking forward to becoming a part of your show this evening. I live in Southwest Washington, and for those not familiar with the area, it's the Cascade Mountains run the length north to south of the state, and I'm situated somewhat between Mount St. Helens and Mount Rainier area. It's a rather mountainous area. I'm in the foothills of the Southwest Washington Cascades where I train my team. I'm a member of the Northwest Sled Dog Association. It's an old sled dog club here that serves the greater Northwest, and found my way into dogs a little later in life than many mushers. I was about midlife when I went into it, but that was about 1992, and we'll be talking about my first dog and how that led ultimately to my Serum Run experience.
And, you know, Vaughn, that was my stomping grounds for a lot of years. I went to school in Portland and am very familiar with that area of the country, and it's a magnificent part of the country. If anybody has not ever been to the Pacific Northwest, that is a place you guys need to visit. It is absolutely beautiful up there.
It's a beautiful area. You've got the water, you've got the mountains, and what we get an awful lot of here is snow. We don't quite get the cold temperatures that you folks do up there in Alaska, but we sure get a lot of snow, and we've got a few feet on our trails at this time.
I believe I read somewhere sometime that the highest snowfall in the continental U.S. was somewhere around your neck of the woods in the Cascades. I forget how many feet, like 50 feet or something like that. It was just an exorbitant number of inches of snow. Do you guys get that much down there?
Well, you're probably talking about Mount Baker, which is a little north of me that I think does hold the record for snowfall, but you know, by January, we've probably got a 6 to 8 foot snow base on our trails, and I'm running on trails that start at about 3,000 feet and run up to about 4,700 feet. So that base builds up pretty good through the winter.
Well, you know, we're taping this show the first weekend in December, and I know we're going to re-air this show during the Serum Run in February, but we just got on our sleds for the first time last night. And a lot of people think, when they think about Alaska, they think about feet of snow and Eskimos and igloos and all that. But really, we haven't had a whole lot up here yet, and we've been running around on quads and snow machines for the last 3 or 4 months.
Well, right, and you know, it's kind of iffy here in the Northwest. Because of La Nina, we suspected we would be on snow by Thanksgiving, and I was actually doing my first sledding the week before Thanksgiving. But, you know, you get those years where you're still on your gig or your quad in December, you know, if it just warms up and you just get the rain.
And it's my understanding that the Northwest Dog Sledding Club, they do a lot of that gig racing, that rig racing that is becoming much more popular, especially in locations such as New Zealand and Australia and even in South America. I know that those guys do quite a bit of that. Are you involved in any of those races in the springtime?
Yes, I am. It is gaining in popularity around the world, and here with the Northwest Sled Dog Association, which has a membership that's inclusive of Washington, Oregon, Idaho, principally, and we have two fall gig races and one spring gig race. The fall races occur in October, and then I think the spring race is around the last week of April, which is really late for the mushing season, but they're very popular here.
You know, I know a lot about those three-wheeled carts. I really cut my teeth on those in the mushing world, and I've been crazy enough to take them out on sheets of ice on the road with 12 dogs that didn't have any clue of what G and Hall were, and I tell you what, that's an experience. And it's interesting, I brought the cart up here with me, and I was telling my new friends here in the neighborhood who are all, you know, very experienced mushers, and they all thought I was crazy to use that kind of cart to train that many dogs. Is that something that you use, or what do you primarily train on before the snow season?
Well, the problem with our Washington trails is quads really aren't legal on our state forest roads.
Uh-huh.
So you're forced into, you know, the heaviest three-wheeler that you can use. If you're on private lands, then you can use a quad. But I run on forest roads, so I use a large three-wheeler. It's an old Risden rig. It's probably 30 or 40 years old. It weighs a little over 300 pounds, and I load it up with some weight. It's, you know, weighs out about 450 by the time I'm on it with some weight. But still, I'm not comfortable running more than 10 or 12 dogs with it. And like you say, when you get to that time of year of transition between fall and winter, when it's icing up, you really can't stop those things, and it gets pretty exciting.
I believe I have the same exact cart you're talking about. Mine was built by an old musher, Frank Hall, who lived up in upper Michigan for years. He was an old school musher, and it's a very similar design to what you're talking about.
Right. It's a good old design.
So we're going to talk today about the Serum Run, and a lot of people know what that is, but aren't quite sure that there's what it's all about with the expedition that goes on every other year, as well as your book, and it's entitled A Long Way to Nome, the Serum Run 25 Expedition, and it was concerning your guys' quest on the 2009 Serum Run, and it's also being held this year as well, and you're going to compete or experience that again. I always want to say compete, and people corrected me so many times up here because it's not a race. It's actually an expedition, isn't it?
Well, thank you for saying so, and that's one of the basic points of confusion for most non-mushers that ask about this event. I explained it. It's not a race. It's a non-competitive event. It was created by the late Colonel Norman Bond to basically commemorate the 20 heroic mushers and their incredible dogs who relayed the antitoxin to diphtheria-stricken Nome in 1925. And he wanted a way to kind of honor the memory of those mushers and reenact the running of that route between Nana and Nome. It's about 800 miles. And it also features a kind of an education or philanthropic component. There's a medical mission team with our expedition, and as we arrive at each of those villages along that original route, the team presents some type of medical education program. And in 2009, it was stroke prevention, and it's very well received by the villagers.
And you guys take the serum. It's not the diphtheria serum anymore, but you guys take the serum from checkpoint to checkpoint, and it's my understanding that each day somebody is picked to be a particular musher from the old days, and you guys take the serum from checkpoint to checkpoint like they did back in the day.
That's exactly right. There is a ceremonial serum packet that's created, and it actually arrives on the Alaska Railroad into Nanana at about 10:30 in the morning, and it's there's just a little whistle stop there. The conductor steps off the train and presents the serum to our trail boss, and then it is handed to musher, you know, musher to musher along the route of the trail. So again, you know, 1925 it was a relay, but in the Serum Run expedition, you know, you're running every mile of the route. But at each village, that ceremonial packet of serum is handed to a different musher to carry it to the next village. So everyone gets a chance to become a part of that experience.
And for people that, again, still are kind of confused between the Iditarod and the Serum Run, the Iditarod was established to kind of commemorate the Serum Run, but also the Serum Run was the actual event that brought the life-saving serum to Nome. And the reason that they had to use dog teams is in the middle of winter, in December, they ran out of antitoxin, and they all of a sudden came down with a diphtheria epidemic in Nome, which is about 1,100 miles from Anchorage. And what they ended up having to do was they couldn't fly because, obviously, in 1925, not very many experienced pilots were flying like they do today. And I'm sure many of the railroads was just getting started as well. But the mail carriers, who were a predominant force in Alaska, volunteered to do this, mail carriers and other mushers. And those are the people that primarily made up this Serum Run relay. And for people that know anything about Balto, and Balto is the famous sled dog who brought the serum into Nome on the dog team there. He's the lead dog. They know him because of the cartoon movie. Isn't that correct?
Pretty much, yeah. Most children that I speak to are familiar with Balto from the recent animated feature.
Right, and a lot of people have heard the name Togo, and of course a lot of mushing people know who the lead dog Togo is, and he was the lead dog for Leonard Seppala, and most of the Siberians today are based off of some strain of the Seppala lines. And then Togo, he was this awesome lead dog, and Leonard Seppala was one of the few mushers that went over 100 miles in the relay, in this relay to save the people of Nome.
Yeah, what Leonard Seppala did in that relay was incredible. He ran the longest distances. Togo, who I think was almost 12 at the time, if I remember his age correctly, was his outstanding lead dog, and there was a real heartfelt connection between Seppala and that particular dog, who led the many miles of that relay that he did. He ran the longest distances. In fact, he had to do some backtracking to kind of get caught up with the whole event.
Right, right. So you participated in 2009, and what an experience that was. Just reading your book, which is a very quick read. What is it, about 100 pages, 120 pages, Vaughn?
Yeah, it's roughly about 125 pages or so.
And you can purchase that right on Amazon.com. Just search Long Way to Nome. And when we do re-air the show, we'll have a link to that site where you can purchase the book. Are there any other places where you can pick it up?
Yes, they can actually get it directly from me, Robert. And if they go to my website, which is callofthewildhuskies.com, and right on the homepage, they can click and order the book right from the homepage.
There you go. So Long Way to Nome, the Serum Run 25 Expedition, and it was about the 2009 Serum Run. So let's jump right into it. The book starts out telling the story of your dog, Wolfie. Can you share a little bit of that story with us?
Yes, I'd love to talk about kind of how this whole thing started. And also, just to prelude that, the reason this book even came to be, Robert, I wanted a way to thank my sponsors who helped me get to Alaska and become a part of this great experience. And so I came up with the idea of a photo journal. When we went through this experience and everything just kind of seemed to go haywire on this expedition, principally due to there were mechanical problems and some really tough weather and deep snow that we faced, the story that came out of it was a little bit amazing to me, and I thought, well, let's just go ahead and publish this. And I was... been really surprised at the outpouring of good words that people have said about it because of how crazy things went up there. The book is heavily illustrated. There's over 150 color photos from the expedition in it, and the whole thing really kicks off with what led me into dog mushing and to become a part of this experience, and that was that very first dog. I think just about anyone you talk to who loves a dog, or particularly mushers, it all starts with this first dog that they really developed this kinship with. And for me, it was a dog named Wolfie. She was an Alaskan Malamute. I got her as a pup back in 1992, and the book really opens with the first day I met this dog and then jumps to the day that I said goodbye to her when she was almost 13. She was riddled with cancer, and in the best words I could find, spoke from the heart to tell what goes through the minds of any person who's so connected to their dog and saying goodbye to them and doing it with honor and grace. And I've been told by a lot of readers that, you know, they have that hanky handy because I think it really harkens to the reader's own experiences with their own dogs, and I think that's why it's just has been popular with the readers that way.
And, of course, you brought Wolfie along in the front of the sled. She was going to follow you on your quest, and that's something that I'm planning on doing myself. And for all the listeners that listen to this show, know the story of our old dog, Aneke, who passed away in July. We've named our Iditarod kennel after our dog. We are Team Aneke, and he is truly the inspiration for our team and our expeditions as well.
So you know how exciting it is to bring their spirit along. I've talked
right.
to a lot of mushers that have brought favorite dogs along in this trail, and as the book tells, you know, when I let this dog go, I told her, I said, if I ever get to Nome, if I get the chance to go to Nome, I'm going to take you with me because you've been such a part. You know, you introduced me to this incredible world of dogs. You taught me all you had to know throughout your life, and you're going to go along, and by golly, I put her in that sled and carried her the length of the trail.
So let's not forget, we do have Michelle from Denver, our co-host. Michelle, pipe in any time, please.
Well, I haven't gotten to read the book, so I don't want to ask questions that are premature, but I don't even think I'm a novice musher, but I have a question about the serum run, Vaughn, if you don't mind. How many people sign up for the serum run? Is there a limit on how many mushers they allow?
That's a great question, Michelle. Thanks. Yeah. Typically, it's limited to about 13 mushers. This year, they extended that to 15 dog teams. And in addition to the 15 dog teams, each driver driving about 12 dogs, there is a snowmobile support team. And this year, I think it numbers 17 or 18 snow machines. And those snow machiners are hauling a Siglin sled with supplies aboard, about 800 pounds worth of supplies, because we all have to haul about 3 days worth of supplies between checkpoints. So it's really, you know, a combination of these dog teams and snow machines traveling between villages at their own pace.
And with that, again, just to parallel with the Iditarod, on the Iditarod, you don't have that, I don't want to call it a luxury, because in the book you talk a lot about how the snow machines were almost a detriment to you guys. But in thinking of the Iditarod, you're literally pulling everything that you have in your sled, whereas on the serum run you do have that support. And we're going to talk about that in just a little bit, about how crucial those snowmobiles, or snow machines as they're called up here, take part in this expedition.
They're a big part of the expedition. And in fact, when we became separated on the Yukon back in 2009, that's what really kept us from finishing our mission. But it's a real intricate part of the team. And what really separates for me the Serum Run expedition experience from Iditarod is the fact that you're not in the race mode. For your listeners that are familiar with the Iditarod race format, where you're kind of running that run 4 hours, rest 4 hours type of format, with the Serum Run, you're running between villages and you're overnighting. So you may be on the runners for 7, 8, 9 hours per day. And when you get to that village, you have the chance to meet with the villagers, talk to the children, visit with the elders. They come out and they see the dogs. They make a really big deal about the dogs coming through the villages. And you really have that connection with the people and the environment and the culture that is so exciting. And the other thing is, along the trail, because you're not racing, if you see something exciting, you kind of got that chance to stop. I remember traveling around one section of the trail and seeing the original old telegraph line from 1925 that was still along certain sections of the trail, and stopping and just looking at that and thinking about the historical significance of that.
And with that, in some of these checkpoints, and you guys use a lot of the same checkpoints that they do use in Iditarod, many of these places are almost ghost towns these days. They might have a population of just a couple of people, but it's amazing how much these people still care about things like this, because in some of these villages, mushing is still a way of life. I know that the snow machines, what a lot of people call the iron dogs, have replaced a lot of things, but there are still people that run trap lines and that sort of thing. So dog sledding in the interior of Alaska is still very much alive and well.
It really is, and it's just exciting when the villagers come out to see the dogs. One thing that my experience showed me was that, and what I heard from the villagers, is that a lot of them don't have dog teams the way they did in the old days. Or I would have youngsters come up and say, you know, my grandpa used to have dog teams like this. A lot of them kind of gone to the iron dog, but some of them still have teams and run the trap lines. But I'll tell you, you get into that village and they're all there to meet you. It's really exciting for them to see you come through there and visit with them.
I have a question. So, Vaughn, it sounds to me like the Serum Run, from what I heard about it, it's nothing for what you guys are describing. It sounds to me like you guys try to embrace what the race or the run was about in 1925, and that was getting medical supplies across the interior. And I think it's remarkable that you guys still do this, or they still do this, as a way to keep the interior connected and make sure that the little villages and townspeople are surviving and doing fine. And you said that you guys take a medical team with you. Do they provide, health care? I don't want to sound like an idiot, but down here in Denver, you know, you have something called the 9 Health Fair, which is a news channel down here where they'll offer you the opportunity to come in and get some free medical care within reason. Most of it's like blood tests and things like that. And I'm just curious to find out, is that what you guys are doing, or is it all about education?
It's more about education, Michelle. It's in 2009, our medical team consisted of a physician, 2 nurses. We also had a pharmacist on the team. And at each village, the doctor and nurses presented a health education program, and in that year it was on stroke prevention, how to identify stroke, you know, what steps to take if a stroke victim is suspected. And it was more of an education program as opposed to a treatment program. And the other thing the expedition team is there to do is to recall and kind of bring alive again those 20 mushers and their dogs that came through those villages, just to keep that heritage alive. That was a real important component by Colonel Vaughn, that he really wanted to kind of keep that element alive, and it's a great thing just to keep that that history alive.
Well, I absolutely agree. I think it's a wonderful thing for mushers to be a part of. And I'm seriously thinking about doing it, but we'll just have to see how good Robert's dogs are.
and you know, Vaughn, that oral tradition is so important to a lot of the smaller communities, not only up here in Alaska, but throughout the country. That's how the Native American people, that's how they survived, is through those old stories. That, you know, that was before the day and age of internet and even newspapers, and of course you were talking about telegraph. That oral history is so vibrant and important to the people of the interior of Alaska.
It really is. I remember when we arrived at Old Minto, which is a very small village. It's the first stop after you leave Nanana. It's about 30 miles from Nanana. And after we arrived there and we were getting the dogs bedded down and feeding them, someone came along the dog team line and said that the village elder wanted everyone to meet in the little, you know, their little common house for a meeting. And we went in there, and the whole village was there, from the little babies all the way up to the elders and all the mushers. And there was a kind of a village discussion there, and it was really interesting to watch how those elders conducted those talks, and I was amazed at the respect the youngsters had for the elders, and everyone talking in turn. The physician was introduced, and he talked about stroke prevention, and it was really elegant. It was a beautiful evening.
And you don't see that kind of stuff on Iditarod, I don't think. So let's get back to the book. A good portion of the first part of the book talks about raising money and getting your equipment together and all the logistics that take part in something as massive as a 2 or 3 2 or 3 week expedition from the Cascades in Washington, and your drive all the way up through the, you know, through the Yukon and in the blizzard of blizzards, and the money that it took to raise and your sponsors and all that. Let's talk a little bit about that, Vaughn.
You bet. You know, I wanted to talk about the title of the book, and I got to give credit to my wife Judith on this. She came up with the title "A Long Way to Nome" as really a metaphor of what it takes to drive a dog team to Nome across Alaska, whether you're with the Cerimone Expedition or whether you're with the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race. When you really measure, you know, the years of experience that you need on the trail and training and camping and dog care and navigation skills and all that knowledge that builds up over the years, and then the preparation for it, that in itself is a real long journey. I measure that as part of that journey to Nome. And, you know, it can take years, as you know, kind of ramping up with your experience. So that's how we came up with that title.
And you said you wrote your book for your sponsors, and I know that you mentioned a lot of those guys in the acknowledgments page, but you couldn't do it without sponsorship for an expedition like this. Is that correct?
It's pretty much true, Robert. As you know, as you're preparing for Iditarod, it's just something you can't do all by yourself. You really surround yourself with the support team. It takes a lot of legwork. There's so many arms and legs to running across Alaska by dog team that you build the best support team you can. You're working with your family, you're working with friends, you're working with businesses, and it all works together to help you and your special dogs make that journey.
And a big part of that, as you mentioned in your book, was getting the time off from work.
Well, it is. You know, I told my wife there were these little episodes in the experience leading up to the expedition that I called deal killers. And it could be the boss saying, no, you can't have the time off. It could be a failing to raise enough money. It could be, you know, not being able to get enough miles on the dogs. There are just so many little obstacles that every musher has to overcome to get to that departure date.
Right, right. So let's hark back. So you're heading up to Alaska now. You're in your dog truck. You got your trailer all loaded up, and you're ready to go. Let's talk a little bit about that trip up the highway.
Well, I'll tell you that the first thing that I remember about that trip was leaving the dogs behind that didn't get to go. And for me, this book talks so much about the relationship between a musher and their dogs, which I think is the focus. And I remember having to leave those dogs behind and kind of getting down the road and feeling a little tearful for those guys that didn't make the team, because you just want everybody to be with you. You're such a family. But it's a long, long drive to Alaska. For anyone that hasn't made it in midwinter, it's an adventure all by itself. It's a couple of thousand miles. It's a very lonely drive. It's very cold. It's very isolated. You might travel hours without seeing another vehicle on the road. And then you're stopping every 2 or 3 hours to get your dogs off the truck, give them that little bio break, give them something to drink, you know, check on everybody. And then I was camping every night right alongside the road and moving along the next day. You're traveling about 12 hours a day, and I drove through a couple of storms that were pretty bad. The snow was pretty deep. You're following a plow in front of you. You're stopping for buffalo on the road in the Yukon area. It's an exciting adventure, just that drive up.
And it's not like the RVs that make that trek so many times. When you're taking a team of dogs up here, like you said, stopping every 2 or 3 hours, and that's not a small chore to drop 12 or 15 dogs out of the truck. That takes a tremendous amount of time. And in 10, 15, 20 below, that is an exhilarating task, isn't it?
It's a lot of work, yeah. You know, you're looking for that spot to stop. You know, you're stopping the truck, you're putting those drop lines out, and you're getting all those kids out. And, yeah, it might be 15, 20 or more below. And, you know, giving everybody the time off the truck, lifting them all back into the truck and getting going down the road again. So you're kind of looking at your watch and making sure they're comfortable. And then that also went for nighttime. You know, when I would stop, I would get those dogs out at least once during the night. And even if it's storming and quite cold, you know, you get up out of that truck, you put your boots on, and you get everybody a break.
So you arrive in Alaska. How many days does it take you?
It's about 6 days up there.
So 6 days. So you arrive in Alaska and stay with a host family in Big Lake. And Big Lake, for people that are trying to get some geography down, Big Lake is just outside of Wasilla, about 10 miles or so outside of Wasilla, and Wasilla is about an hour from Anchorage. And then Nenana is about, 280 miles from Big Lake or so?
Yeah, I guess something like that.
So you're staying with a host family in Alaska. Is that your first time up here?
No, I've been to Alaska many times. I actually have done a little business up there as well, and I've been visiting Alaska for quite a few years, and I just always love visiting there. I do have quite a few friends in Alaska, and I was blessed to have the opportunity to stay with a great host family right there in Big Lake, where I was able to train right out of their driveway during the time between my arrival in Alaska and the beginning of the Serum Run expedition.
And in Big Lake, for people that are listening that are mushers, that's the home of Martin Boozer, and I believe his kennel is called Happy Dog Kennel. Is that right?
Something, yeah, I could be wrong in the title, but it's
Happy Trail.
Close to
Happy
that.
Trails. I apologize. Happy Trail Sled Dog Kennel.
Now, but what I can tell you is in the evening, I could hear Martin's dog team straight across the lake singing, and you know, my dog's answering and singing back. And I've got a great story about training there in Big Lake that I'd love to share with you and
sure.
your listeners. As I heard you and Michelle talking about, you know, the dangers of running on ice and that sort of thing in the early winter, but I was there at the 1st of February to train, and I remember one day running my dog team the length of Big Lake and then out on the flat lake, kind of running lake to lake there. And one day I was running on the lake, which is also used for commuters that want to take a shortcut across the lake so they don't have to drive around. But one day I heard this rumbling sound behind me, and I turned around, and there was literally a caravan of three or four fully loaded cement mixers on the trail where I was running my dog team or on this across this ice. And I thought, by golly, if those things can make it across, I guess our dog team is going to be as safe as we can be out here. But I never imagined seeing cement mixers crossing that lake in winter.
Yeah, that would be a scary thing. And we were just running across the lakes just this last week when Michelle was up here, and she was scared to death we were going to break through.
Well, tell Michelle by midwinter if a cement mixer can get across, she has no worries.
There you go. So you're up here in Big Lake, and you're doing your training, and things are getting ready, and you're ready to head up to the start of the Serum Run, and things start going the wrong way from day one, don't they?
Almost, yeah. There was just seemed to be just these bad little things that were happening. I was caravanning up with one of the other mushers, and he broke leaf springs in his trailer, and we had to repair that halfway up and, you know, working together to get him up there. I remember when I arrived in Nenana, we got there a little late due to that mechanical repair. The first thing I'm told is that my snow machine partner that I've been partnered with for this expedition, Phil Presmont, who's an outstanding backcountry guide from Nome, was missing on the Caltech Portage. He was making his way by snow machine from Nome to Nenana to meet up with us and had been lost in a storm there. So, of course, I'm worried about him. I realize I don't have a snow machine partner, and we're going to be leaving Nenana in a few hours, and that's just where things started to go sideways the night before we were going to leave.
And that's a common occurrence for people to get lost out on the trails, whether it's on dog teams or snowmobiles or whatever. People are often lost on these trails in this treacherous weather that people are out trekking around in.
Well, exactly. Or you could have a mechanical failure, which I think was what happened to Phil, was a problem with his snow machine. And luckily, he's an experienced backcountry traveler, and he had everything he needed, but he was stuck out there and unable to meet up with us.
So you hooked up with another snow machine partner. Who was that, and how does that team work? A lot of people, I'm sure, are going to ask that question. Do they carry your gear, or do they just carry gear in mass, and you just kind of pick and choose when you get to the checkpoints?
They're carrying gear for the two of you. So they are carrying my extra dog food. They're carrying a couple of dog crates. They're packing some straw. They're packing some plastic totes that have my gear in it. I have everything on my sled that I can get into it. But they're hauling this Siglin trailer behind them that is weighted with about 800 pounds of supplies. And I was teamed up with Amy Whistler, who was the team pharmacist, and she did a great job. We actually met each other the first time that morning we were leaving. We discussed very quickly what my gear was and what I needed to load on her sled, and she was great. She got it loaded down and strapped down, and off we went. When you get to each destination, that snow machine partner will be there to help make sure you have off of their supply sled what you need for that particular evening or that stop.
So kind of like a personal handler.
Well, yeah, in a way it is. And, yeah, you're working together, and, you know, you may travel a little bit together on the trail, but pretty much everyone is traveling at their own speed.
So what's the tipping requirement for them?
Boy, I don't think there's enough money. You're very nice to them. Let me say that. You're very nice to them.
I'm just wondering how much banana bread I need to bake.
Oh, all you can make. Oven's worth.
So, Vaughn, as you're heading out of that first checkpoint, you have quite a little first ride there, and one of your top dogs is injured. That was Blackjack. Am I correct?
Yeah, we're maybe just 10 miles out of Nanana, and you're kind of always looking up the team, and I noticed one of the dogs, you know, he's not moving quite right, and I stopped the team on, and it's very icy there, and I noticed that he's got some swelling in one of his ankles. I load him onto the sled. I carry him a few more miles. A snow machiner comes by, and they're equipped with a crate to carry a dog if a dog becomes tired or injured, and I load him into that crate. Also, on this expedition, we had two veterinarians with us. And at that checkpoint that evening, or that first village in Old Minto, Dr. Vanek, one of our veterinarians, examined the dog, and he had had an ankle injury and had to be dropped from the team from that first day. So right there out the, you know, I'm not 10 miles down the trail, and I've got a dog with a bad ankle.
And that, again, that's the true start of your expedition, and already you've already had two or three things go wrong, and you're just getting started. You're what, 600 miles, 700 miles from Nome at that point, and things are already happening where it could jeopardize what the future holds.
Well, you know, like I say, it's just not even 24 hours, and I don't have my original snow machine partner. I've got one dog dropped, and I think by the time we got the first or second day, there was a snow machine engine that seized it up or something like that. Over the next two or three days, there was another machine that fried a transmission. There were some drive belts that failed. There were some delays in some of the villages just to try to bring in parts and get those snow machines fixed, because we are traveling pretty much as a group, which is probably the major difference between Iditarod and the Sierraman expedition, is the fact that you're kind of traveling as a team rather than just yourself competitively. You're trying to get this whole group of snow machiners and dog mushers from village to village together each day. So when you have, you know, mechanical problems, that kind of can bog things down a bit.
So I don't want to give away the entire book, of course, but as Blackjack is injured and is that a male or a female?
He's a male.
So as you drop him from the team, and he ends up going back to have surgery, is that correct, in Fairbanks?
Right. We actually carried him on the trail for 3 days, and when we got to Manly Hot Springs, there's a road that goes up to Fairbanks, and there was someone who had come down from Fairbanks and was able to transport him back into a great veterinary clinic where he received some great care, and things turned out pretty well for him.
So you're running the expedition this year. Is Blackjack joining you?
He is joining me. Yeah, he actually returned to the team the next year. He ran races for me last year here in the greater Washington area, and he will become a part of that team. But I'll tell you, when I had to put him in that vehicle and say goodbye to him in Manly Hot Springs, it just really tears your heart out every time you say goodbye to one of these dogs. You expect that you're all going to be there in Nome together, but when you have to send one home, it's the hardest thing you're going to experience. It's harder than bad weather. It's harder than the personal hardship. To separate yourself from any of your dogs is the single most difficult thing you'll do.
And that's very similar to the way that they do it on Iditarod. They have an entire Air Force that takes part in that, in relaying volunteers back and forth and taking dogs back and forth that are dropped. And that's a whole process that makes the Iditarod such a logistical feat And you guys are doing it in a group of what, 15 or about 30 people?
That's about it, yeah.
Right, right. Okay, so you've now lost Blackjack. You've got a new snow machiner. You're heading down the trail there. What's the next adventure you want to talk about?
Oh, gosh. You know, I really got to talk about what happened when we got to Tanana on the Yukon River. The whole team managed to arrive there. We were already a few days behind schedule due principally to mechanical problems. But there was a series of really bad storms that were sweeping over Alaska that year. They're coming in from the coast and blowing into the interior and dropping a lot of snow. And I remember the morning we woke up in Tanana that the Yukon was just had been deluged with like 6 feet of snow or something. And it was determined that we weren't going to be able to move down that section of the river from Tanana as far as Ruby. It's a little over 100 miles. And so after some discussion, it was decided to air portage our dogs over that bad section of trail. And did that turn out to be an exciting experience?
Dogs don't necessarily care for airplanes, do they?
Boy, I'll tell you. So what I learned was what was going to happen was we were going to move these dogs in very small airplanes, all of the dogs. So that meant moving them to a little airstrip outside of the village. We loaded them into these little wooden crates and towed them with a snow machine out to an airfield. And when I arrived there with one other musher, we were going to move two teams at a time. I was waiting to see what kind of airplane we were going to get. And out of the sky lands this little single-engine Cessna. It was a Cessna Caravan. It's a small airplane. It seems small to me. And onto this plane, we were going to load two dog teams, so that was going to be 23 Huskies and two fully loaded expedition sleds. And they weighed 200, 300 pounds each. And for your listeners, I want them to imagine an area about the size of a dining room table for 12. And in that, you're going to load two dozen dogs. Two of these teams don't even know each other, so you're wondering, is there going to be an altercation? Is there going to be a problem? Are the dogs going to get along? You've got the sled sitting in the middle. Is the cargo going to shift? You know, it was a stormy day. The wind was blowing. I remember when we loaded the last dog, Teak, one of my dogs, and I shoved him into the last few square inches, and each dog was necklined to this picket line running around the floor of this airplane. We closed the door, and the wind was just blowing. It was blowing snow, and I looked at the pilot, and I said, "Are we okay in this?" And he points to the door of the airplane. He says, "Get in." And I got in the airplane with one other musher and this one pilot. And he lit up that engine, and I turned around, and I looked at the dogs, and I yelled over the sound of that engine, "Well, whatever happens next, we're all in this together." And off we went to Ruby.
And you have some pretty cool pictures in the books of the dogs looking there in the airplane like, "Oh, my God, what in the world have I got myself into?"
There's some great pictures. It's worth the price of the book just to see the looks on these dogs' faces, many of whom I'm sure had never flown before, and to be in a small airplane with no personal space between them at all, on top of each other, shoulder to shoulder, and to be in this airplane and take off in the storm, it was rather frightening for them. I'll tell you, their ears flattened, and they were just quivering little balls of jelly.
And there was no fights?
There were absolutely no fights. That was the beauty of it. There were no altercations. They just seemed to respect each other's very limited space. They just really sensed, I think, that they just needed to remain calm, and they did so. There were no problems with the dogs in any of those flights getting us over to Ruby.
And people that are listening, just to let you know that those airplane pilots, they are the lifeline of Alaska. They're delivering mail and food and supplies and everything that that these villages need, because there's not many roads out that way. And those guys take a tremendous amount of risk to do these things. And, of course, as they say on Sarah Palin's show, that's probably why there are more airline fatalities in Alaska than anywhere else, just because so many of these people have to fly from point A to point B just to get a letter from grandma.
You're absolutely right. Those airplanes, those small planes, really connect that state. And it was a little bit of a frightful situation for me. I know, especially was for the dogs, but I really sense that for that pilot, it was another day on the job. I mean, they are
right.
Amazing people.
So you land. You're landing in Ruby. Is that no? You don't land in Ruby, but you have to run into Ruby after you land. Is that right?
Right, right. The plane set down in this open area, and there were no buildings. There was nothing around. He lands in this snowfield, and he orders, you know, get out of the plane as quick as you can. Get all your gear out, and stuff is literally being kind of thrown out of the airplane. We're getting the dogs out and trying to set up a picket line, and off he takes off, you know, trying to get back before dark. And almost out of nowhere, there's a couple of snow machines come up, and it's a couple of local villagers from Ruby that are there to get our dog teams down into the village. And we hooked up a little gang line to the front of the snow machine and loaded, you know, my sled and some gear in this little tote sled he had behind the snow machine and drove my dog team into Ruby. And
so
but as it turned out, only 6 of the 8 dog teams managed to get into Ruby that day.
So one thing that we need to mention here is the snow machines, they had to run from Tanana, right?
They were supposed to run from Tanana and catch up to us in Ruby.
And that's where things really started getting hairy for you guys, is that snow machine support that had all your guys' gear was hemmed up because of the storms and all that, and things really started getting scary for you guys because you didn't know what was going to happen. Here you guys, separated from miles apart from each other, you know, all of your gear is in one place, but thankfully you guys, at least 6 of you guys are together. So tell us a little bit about the run up the Yukon.
Well, you know, that night before we left Ruby to head up to Galena, and it's about 60 miles on the Yukon, and there was a lot of anxiety among the 6 mushers because there was so much we didn't know. There was so little communication possible between us and our snow machine support team. We didn't know whether they were going to have difficulty making it down the river, were they going to be able to punch through that deep snow okay. We did get one phone call out, and what we were told by Aaron, our musher team leader, was the 6 of us were to take our dog teams and drive to Galena and meet up with everybody there and find out, you know, kind of go over our action plan from there. So we didn't really have a weather report. We didn't know what to expect. Was another storm going to blow through? They seemed to be coming through every 2 or 3 days and bringing all this heavy snow. And one of the mushers had a watch with a barometer on it, and the barometric pressure went flat. So when we got up in the morning, it was about 3 or 4 degrees. The skies were clear, and we decided, let's go. We're going to get to Galena, you know, as quickly as we can. And when we get there, we'll find out, you know, what's happened to our snow machine support. So as we left Ruby, we were already 100 miles ahead of the rest of the team. We made that long drive to Galena. You know, there was no marking on the trail per se. We just kind of, the dogs just seemed to follow an old scent trail, I guess. And we got into Galena that night. It's really a little unnerving the first time you come into Galena because you kind of overshoot the lights to get into the village. You almost think you're driving past it. And you've been in the dark for a few hours by that time. It was about 40 below. And finally we found our way into that village and got in there around, I guess, 10, 11 o'clock at night. And our other 2 dog teams had been airported all the way to Galena. They had overshot Ruby that day while we were driving our dog teams downriver and met us there. And it was the next morning when we got the fateful phone call from our snow machine support team back in Tanana with the bad news about the trail.
So let me interrupt you right there just for a second, Vaughn. I want to ask you about the trail on the Yukon. The Yukon is as big as the Mississippi, is it not?
I presume so. Yeah, it seemed like it was almost, you know, half a mile wide in places. It's a large, wide river.
And what is the guy's name that said in the book, this run here could very well be the last of our run? Who was that?
That was Don Duncan, one of our veteran mushers, a veteran of the 2007 run.
And what did he say exactly? I'm probably misquoting there.
Yeah, what Don Duncan wanted to share with me, one of our team mushers that year, was he said as we left Ruby, and we were the last 2 to leave Ruby, he says, really enjoy this run. He goes, this could be our last day of the run, because he realized that we were so far ahead of the snow machine support team, and with the bad trail on the river, if they couldn't meet us at Galena, our mission may be called off. And just, you know, to make the most of that run, and I certainly did. Let me tell you, it was on my mind during that run. But it was on that run that I really gained a respect for how vast Alaska is. You know,
right.
For someone from the lower 48 to go there and run down that river, and people have asked me what it's like, and I said, remember the last time you walked down the beach and you're looking down at the sand and you see that little sand crab kind of inching along in the sand, and then you look up at the vista of the beach and the ocean and how big and vast it is and how small that sand crab is. That's how I felt going down the river with the dog team. You're just a speck on the landscape.
And you're out there literally alone.
You're out there alone. You know, it was just our six dog teams working our way to Galena and hoping that we got in there before weather came in, because we had no idea what the weather was going to do next.
And the parallel I want to bring up here is the Iditarod with that kind of that finality of the expedition or of the race. And a couple of weeks ago, we had on Craig Medred, who is a reporter, used to be a reporter for the Anchorage Daily News and is now a reporter for the Alaska Dispatch. And he wrote a book called Graveyard of Dreams, which is about mushers, you know, coming to all of those terms on the trail of spending years and years and years preparing for this race. And at some point, it's over. And some point, sometimes it's in Nome, sometimes it's you know, 100 miles into the trail, sometimes it's a broken sled, a busted nose, all sorts of things. It's truly heartbreaking when you're there and you've prepared all this time for this, and then all of a sudden, it's right there in your face, wow, this might be the last run of this adventure.
You're right, and that's where it all came to a head on that morning in Galena when, you know, the dogs are ready to go. And we got a call there that said that our snow machine support team just was going to be unable to meet up with us. And they were turning back and heading back to Nanana, and we were going to have to find our way home. And I remember going out to the dog team and just kneeling down with each of them and saying, you know, kids, this is the end of our trip, and just telling them how much I love them and how proud I was of their effort. But, it was really at that moment, Robert, that I really started to learn an important lesson from those dogs, and you know, and I've always felt like I'm the kind of person that's learning things all my life. And on that expedition, on that day when we realized we weren't going to go to Nome, I learned one of the greatest life lessons I've ever been taught by these dogs. And as you know, dogs, they live in the moment, and that's such a great lesson to learn from them. And for those dogs, there was no disappointment. You know, when people have asked me, Vaughn, were you disappointed you didn't get to Nome? I said, yes. I said, but you know, what I learned from those dogs is they never knew they were going to a place called Nome. For those dogs, every day of that journey was an adventure. They'd get up in the morning, they'd get off their beds of straw, they'd shake their tails and shake their coats and look forward to being harnessed and going down the trail and making every minute of that trip exciting for them. And I realized that that's really what that journey was all about. You know, it was every minute with those dogs. It was being in the moment. Apollo Ono, the great Olympic skater, he has a great quote that says, the journey is the destination. And I realized that, you know, that's really what that trip was all about. And then I kind of extended it to a life philosophy. You know, it's not about being born and dying. It's about that journey in between and making the most of it. And so while we didn't get to Nome, making the most of every minute of that experience, especially with all the stuff that went haywire, and letting that enrich our lives, really made that trip worth doing for me. And I told Aaron afterwards, I said, even had I known it would turn out like this at the beginning, I wouldn't have passed up this experience for anything.
So, Vaughn, can you stay with us a few more minutes? I'd like to continue on. I just want to take a quick break. We're running out of our time, but it will still stream. Can you stay with us for a few more minutes?
I'd be delighted.
All right, we'll be right back after this.
Dog Works Radio and Mush You Huskies is fueled by Native Performance Dog Food. If you want the best for your canine athlete or working dog, we recommend Native Performance Dog Food. Available at Dog Works Training Centers. Call 303-578-9881 for more information. Native Performance Dog Food.
Are you looking for a career you will love? Do you want to be the best? DogWorks Training Centers has business opportunities in your area. Give us a call at 303-578-9881. We have the best and train the rest.
You are listening to DogWorks Radio. We have the best and train the rest. Now back to the show.
And we are back. I absolutely love that commercial spot that Michelle recorded on the fly for us for our DogWorks Training Centers. We are talking to Von Martin, the author of A Long Way to Nome, the Serum Run 25 Expedition. I am hosting from Willow, Alaska, and on the line is also the co-host, Michelle, my wife, Michelle. Michelle, are you still there?
I am still here. I was enjoying the stories and what you guys were talking about, and I know a lot of our listeners are very interested in learning about the Serum Run, because I don't think a lot of people realize that that race is still run, and I think that a lot of people really don't understand that it has more to do with the romanticism of dog sledding, more so than the Iditarod, in my opinion. The Iditarod is to me, the good old boys type of a race, and the Serum Run is much more about giving back, so I'm enjoying it.
And Vaughn, do you care to comment on that?
Well, you know, as I was saying earlier to the listeners, it's a very different type of experience from the Iditarod race. I'd like to encourage the listeners to take a look at the website for the Serum Run, and that's serumrun.org.
And they have a Facebook page as well. You can just search Serum Run on the Facebook search bar, and I'm sure anywhere on Google or Bing or Yahoo or anything will take you to some of those sites. And we're going to talk about this year's race in just a couple of minutes. But beforehand, when we left there, Vaughn, you were talking about the connection that you have with your dogs. And something that a friend of mine, a Iditarod musher, his name is Hugh Neff. Hugh Neff mentioned that this sport of dog sledding cannot evolve unless it's more about the dogs. And I think that is probably one of the most profound statements I've heard in a long time about this sport. We hear so much about the mushers, so much about the big names and the big sponsors and the Iditarod and how commercial it is and TV deals and dog food companies and all that, but it's truly a connection that we have with our dogs that make this sport and this adventure so special.
Boy, Robert, you hit the nail right on the head. That's really what it's all about. And that part of it, I think, is underplayed sometimes. You know, there is an emphasis on the event and the logistics of how far the event is, but it's really all about the dogs. And it's particularly about the relationship between the humans and their canine counterparts, between men and women and their dogs. That relationship is so extraordinary. Many times it's a lifelong relationship, you know, bringing that dog into the world or adopting it from someone and giving that dog that life experience of running all those miles. And let me tell you, when that day comes, and I call it a day of honor, when you help that dog cross the Rainbow Bridge over to the other side, it just tears your heart out, because when you think about where that dog has carried you and taken you, and when you are there to finally say goodbye, there's nothing quite like it. It's just an extraordinary experience.
And we interviewed Alex Stein. He did a behind-the-scenes documentary about the Iditarod. And as a matter of fact, I just saw the premiere today in Anchorage. I had to really bust it back up here to get back for this show. But one of the profound interviews in that movie was one of the Iditarod mushers says, "There's no glory in the Iditarod. You know, you're cleaning up poop for 50 weeks of the year. It's cold, it's miserable, it's freezing. But being out there on that trail with your dogs, that's where that connection comes. And you know, a lot of people just don't understand that." But I think that they do a little bit when they think about their personal dogs and pets, whatever it is, whether it's a dog, a cat, an iguana, whatever, is that bond that we have. And just think about having that bond out there on the trail in the middle of nowhere traveling 100 miles a day in the middle of the night in freezing cold temperatures, sometimes 20 or 30 below, and you know that that bond that you have with those dogs is literally the lifeline that will get you to the next checkpoint or the next stopover or whatever you're doing in that adventure that we love and call dog mushing.
It is. You know, your lives are intertwined, and they're dependent on one another. And you're watching those dogs go down the trail hour after hour, and you ask yourself, how do they do it? You know, they're amazing athletes. And what's most amazing is they do it because they want to do it. They want to do it for you. You know, their unconditional love for what they do and for you is the reason they'll run that many miles. And they just absolutely relish and love every minute. And when you get to that end of the day and you give them that meal and those hugs, you know, your debt to them is fully repaid. That's just how they are. They're amazing creatures to share your life with.
And I think, just again, another Iditarod parallel, I think that's what Lance Mackey's edge is he has that unbelievable connection with his dogs. And I don't know how many dogs he has at his kennel. I'm thinking at least 60. I'm not sure exactly how many he has. But he has that unbelievable connection that is so important to a dog team.
You're right, and Lance has an extraordinary ability, as do all the front runners, to bring out the best in those dogs, and those dogs are doing it because they really want to do it for you.
And there's true meaning behind the term "born to run." That's what these guys were born and bred to do. You know, there's a lot of talk out there about the Siberians and the Alaskan Malamutes and things still being able to do what they were bred to do. But they're still out there enjoying their time. And as a matter of fact, you guys had a team of Samoyeds, didn't you?
Yeah. In fact, Don Duncan, one of my mushing colleagues, runs a team of Samoyeds. And Don ran that event from Nanana to Nome in 2007. He was with our 2009 team, and he is returning again in 2011 to run those Samoyeds across Alaska. I don't know that it's ever been done by any other musher. I don't know that any other musher has driven a team of Samoyeds across that state, but it's amazing what he has done with those dogs.
And those dogs, they were bred for this. They were reindeer hunters on the trails up here in this neck of the woods, and they were pulling the sleds and carrying on. But a lot of people think about the Sammies of just being these cute little white puffballs, but they're truly hardy dogs.
They are truly hardy dogs. They're fabulous traveling dogs. And when you really look into history and review those dogs that were used in those early Arctic and Antarctic expeditions, the Samoyed played a large role.
Right, right. Okay, so let's switch gears a little bit. Let's finish up the expedition, so to speak. So you guys have gotten the devastating news. Now it's time to pack up and go. And you're flying from Galena to Fairbanks. Is that right?
That's right. Galena, for those listeners that aren't familiar with it, it sits on the Yukon. There's an abandoned air base there, so there's a landing strip there. And it was two or three days before an old DC-6 chartered plane could make it into there between storms. And it was at about 2 in the morning, I remember. And that plane came in, and we loaded those sleds and almost 80 Huskies onto that airplane in the middle of the night. It was pitch dark. It was snowing. And I'll never forget the sound of those four big radial engines when they lit up. And that plane took off down that runway. There were no lights on it, and it just disappeared into the wintry night sky with that snow falling around. And just it was a very tearful moment to see your dogs, you know, taken away from you and returned actually to Anchorage. And there we were having to find our own way home on smaller planes via Fairbanks the next day, and it was really tough to see those dogs take off and know that it was all over.
So you arrive in Fairbanks, and there's a real story there. What happens in Fairbanks with your buddy there?
Oh well, you're talking about Blackjack?
Yes.
Well, I actually had to drive up to recover Blackjack later on my way out of Alaska, but he had been to a veterinarian, and they had found he had had a what they call a dropped hock. It was a partial tear of a tendon in his ankle, and he was in a leg cast. And he was staying with a mushing friend of mine, and that musher had said that Blackjack was so well socialized, he got along with all their dogs. But I remember walking into the house, and Jack hadn't seen me in a couple of weeks, and he just looked at me like, where have you been and where did you come from, boss? It's good to see you. And I loaded him into the truck and drove him home. He was out of that cast in a few weeks, and I'm so delighted he'll be a part of our 2011 team.
So you make it back to Anchorage, and you're heading home. How long is this adventure from point A back to home? What are we talking about in terms of time?
That's a good 8 weeks. Yeah.
8 weeks. Right.
Yeah, you're eight weeks away from home, and it's a long trip.
And you pointed out something that is probably the most entertaining line in the entire book, and I just want to backtrack just a second, is when you arrive back to Big Lake, you say that you've been in the same clothes since when you left Washington the first time.
Yeah, I had. They've been
I can only imagine.
A couple of times, yeah. You know, well, you get a little ripe when you're making those trips, you know, whether it's a Iditarod or Sarum Run. You know, there is the chance to do a little showering and laundry along the way, but, gosh, you know, you do stay on those clothes a long, long time.
That's something to hang up in a memorial somewhere.
I think your clothes will stand up by themselves.
There you go.
Hang them against the wall, yeah.
So you arrive home, you get back to work, you're happy to see your wife and all the dogs you left behind, and that was just about 2 years ago today, you know, at this point in 2008, 2009. So here you are doing it again in 2011, February of 2011. What have you learned? How are you a different musher? What's going to be different this time from last time? So let's bring it to the present a bit.
You bet. Well, I'll tell you, having done it before is a little bit of a double-edged sword. You know, there's some friends of mine said, well, you should feel more confident because you've already been there. But, you know, there's ignorance is bliss to a point. You know, when I went there the first time, I didn't really fully know what to expect, and your expectations are very high. Now I've come away with some experience of running those longer runs and at those very cold temperatures, but seeing what my dogs could do, so I'm encouraged by the knowledge that those dogs could do more than I even expected they could. And about going back, Robert, you know, first you got to go to your spouse and explain to them you need to do this again, and that's a difficult thing to do. You know, you understand from your own personal experience, I'm sure, and there's listeners and mushers out there that know there's a lot of dynamics at play between you and your spouse and the sacrifice involved in doing this type of event. And when I went to Judith and said, I need to go back and do this again, and my reason was I just want to finish what we started. I just want to give these dogs this legacy. And the other thing about these dogs is this is probably their last event. Most of the dogs I'm taking on this run are 10 and 11 years old. I've got a leader who's 12. He's the same age as Togo when Togo did that last run. And I really want this for them. I want to see them on that beach. I want to feel like they completed this legacy and brought this experience full circle. I'll just be so happy for them to know that this is possible. And that's what really drove my desire to come back in 2011 and take a shot at this. And I feel very confident about our success. We've got a great team put together this year, a lot of experience on our team.
And speaking with Erin McLarnon, who is the musher coordinator, and I believe she is now the president of the Sarum Run, she spends a heck of a lot of time preparing for this. It takes a tremendous amount of her time and her effort, and she has two or three other jobs on top of that, so I can just imagine what logistics she's going through. But it is a big deal. I mean, it's not something you just sign up like a race. You just don't sign up for it and show up and you're ready to go. This is something that takes a tremendous amount of time and effort.
It does. There's conference calls every month for several months leading up to it. The team is jumping on. Erin is talking about, you know, the responsibilities of the mushers and the snow machiners and what to expect. And there's, you know, there's things you have to do and take care of along the way. And so you really get that sense of a team effort and cohesiveness from the very beginning, as opposed to kind of arriving with your dogs at the beginning of a race and running your race. It's a very different experience that way.
Right. Michelle, anything else you want to add?
No, are you
there? We might be losing her, so we'll let it go. Vaughn, what do you want to close with?
Hello,
are you there?
Oh, yep. She's back. Can you hear us?
I can. I thought I lost you guys for a minute. I just would like to say that I think that this is a wonderful topic, and I hope that we can, you know, explore the serum run in a little bit more depth.
Well, we want to have Erin on the show, but she says she's not a big talker on the radio and TV and things, so that's why we have Vaughn on. I was thinking about Vern Halter. He's also one of my neighbors here. Vaughn, it's been a true pleasure, and I look forward to having some more conversations. Our plan is to have you back on when you guys are finished this year. It'll be early March. Is that right?
Yeah, it should be about mid-March we should arrive in Nome, and I would be delighted to come back on and share the experience with the listeners.
Well, we might have to have you on a live broadcast. If you're coming back through this way, we'll catch you up and put a microphone in front of your face and do it live next time.
That'd be a lot of fun.
So what do you want to end with here, Vaughn? Do you want to tell us again how we can get your book, your website? I know you have some sponsorship opportunities on your website as well where you can sponsor a dog and things like that. Do you care to mention any of that?
Well, yes. You know, for all your listeners out there, if they're interested in a book that's really mostly about the relationship between humans and their dogs, which is really what the book is about, set against the landscape and an experience in Alaska, pick the book up. I think it's a book you'll really enjoy. You can read through it in an evening or two. It's beautifully illustrated. It gives you a lot of visual references to traveling with your dogs in Alaska. And they can get the book again at Amazon.com. It's called A Long Way to Nome. It's also available at my website, callofthewildhuskies.com. And the last bit of news or message I'd like to leave with all the listeners is what Norman Vaughn said at one point in time. It was really my reason for going back to Alaska. You know, Colonel Vaughn once said, and I think in reference to his failure to climb a mountain in Antarctica the first time he tried to do it, and he said, "You don't always make it the first time. You go back and you try again. It's all an adventure." And I think that applies to just about everything anybody wants to do in life that they really have a passion for. If you don't make it the first time, go back and try it again and find your success, find your joy.
You can't end it better than that, Vaughn. It's been a pleasure. Michelle, we'll be back on the air on Wednesday. We're talking about a wolf dog that is separated from his U.S. soldier who is in Afghanistan, and we're going to have those guys on Wednesday evening. And the next Sunday, I have no idea what we're going to be doing, but I look forward to it. Vaughn, it's been a pleasure. We'll stay in touch. You are on Facebook if people want to look you up. You're right there, and you're pretty active on there as well. You got to love social media, huh?
That's great. I love it. It's a great way to stay connected.
It is. Vaughn, it's a pleasure. We'll talk again soon, okay?
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Michelle, let's run it out.
All right.
This is Robert Forteau for Michelle Forteau. This is Mush You Huskies. Never forget your dreams. We'll see you guys next week. Goodbye.